Welcome to this special edition series, A Strategic View of Hiring, a series of discussions to help you think through and implement smarter and more impactful strategies to recruit and develop world-class talent for your organization. And now, here is our series host, Mr. Rick Thiemann.
Welcome back to A Strategic View of Hiring. I am one of your hosts, Todd Schnick, joined, as always, by our series host, Mr. Rick Thiemann. Rick, my friend, good to see you.
Absolutely.
Looking forward to this one. This is going to be, if you have taken the time to listen to our previous episodes, this one's going to be a bit different, a little deeper, a little bit more technical. It's going to be fascinating. We're going to talk about a very real issue in hiring. That's dealing with unreliable behaviors. We might even touch on something like substance abuse today, and all very real factors when it comes to talent recruitment. One wishes, Rick, that we didn't have to really address these kinds of topics, but it's the reality of talent recruitment. And on this show, we've talked a lot about normal and abnormal behaviors. We've talked about identifying areas of potential concern. And most importantly, we've talked about how to put this testing tool in your toolbox so that you can really make some smarter decisions when it comes to hiring. Get into that for us. And there's some pretty interesting studies that kind of are the foundation of what we're talking about today. So let's get into this.
Yeah. So we're going to get a lot more technical in terms of the factors and interpretation with today's episode. And it may be hard to follow from time to time because if you're not familiar with kind of the model, so to speak. But when you start to look at understanding behavior, as we've talked in the past, your predictive index, your DISC, your Berkman, your caliper, you know, all of your four-dimensional tests only measure normal behavior. They don't measure abnormal behavior. And the reports that are produced out of a DISC report or predictive index, or they all produce computer-generated reports of some sort, the language is often so soft that you really wouldn't know if there's any really major problems or not. Because they're designed to be shared with others, they're designed to make, you know, help people look at their strengths and weaknesses from a more positive light. So there's not a lot of negativity in those reports. But in our reports, because of the way we've designed them, we can get pretty dicey with some of our terminology. In other words, we're not afraid to talk about a person's anger or aggression tendencies. Most assessments can't pick that out anyway. But in the world of what we do, using the 16PF and the factors that are there, we know that through Dr. Carson's work, Dr. Michael Carson, who wrote the book 16PF in Clinical Practice and has been 40 plus years in the industry using the 16PF and all his research, in his book, he outlines what he refers to as areas of potential concern. What does that mean? So in the areas of potential concern, those are correlated to the maladaptive or the abnormal aspects of behavior. And in the 16PF, there are theoretically 32 factors because you've got a left-hand meaning and you've got a right-hand meaning. And those are based on a 10-point scale on a range of 1 to 10. And so when we know there are certain factors, if they are so high in the 9 and 10 range, that they could be problematic. And we know that there are certain scores when they're so low, like scores of 1 or 2, that they may also be equally problematic. And understanding what those factors are it's all about what Dr. Carson generated in his book, 16PF in Clinical Practice. So there are 15 identifiable potential abnormal behaviors that could be produced in someone's report. And in the reports that Michael Carson developed, and he and I worked together to kind of expand those assessments, there's a section in each of those reports referred to as areas of potential concern. And what that really means is that when there are any behaviors that are deemed likely problematic, they're going to get flagged and they're going to get populated on that page. So if you get a what we call a personnel report, if you get that report back from us and you flip to the areas of potential concern page, if that page is blank, that's a much more positive thing than if you have four or five things that are on there that show to be areas of concern.
So help me understand. So there are 15 potential areas of concern. Is that the right number?
Correct.
So on the average person who does your assessment, how many of those areas of potential concern does the average person generally flag?
One, maybe two.
Okay. So the average person doesn't show half of these.
No.
The average person shows one, maybe two.
Yeah. If for somebody who's pretty well balanced, pretty even keeled, pretty down to earth, pretty grounded, yeah, you'll see it on what we consider more of a normal profile.
And just to reiterate what you said earlier, the 16PF, which is where this is based from, is one of the assessment tools in your battery of assessments that you do for your clients. It's a very comprehensive test. I mean, this is not something that gives you a couple of readout scores. This is a very deep, very in-depth. So for the average person to come through that assessment and only show maybe one or two areas of potential concern tells you that's a pretty good candidate out of the gate.
Yeah, normally. It depends on, you know, there are some of the 15 factors, there are a couple that are a little bit more egregious than others.
Sure.
Right? And there are some of those factors that would correlate more to job specific. So for instance, on what we call our factor A, which is friendly versus, you know, more reserved or aloof, you know, on the low side, that in some cases that could be problematic because it borders on being antisocial. But it wouldn't be a problem for an over-the-road truck driver who's by himself all the time.
Sure.
Right? So you have to kind of look at behavior as it applies to the role. And back to some of our previous conversations, behavior is the biggest predictor of performance.
Right.
So if you can predict the behavior and map that to a specific role, whether it's a sales role or customer service role or a VP role or an engineering role or a marketing role or accounting role, right? You can map those behaviors to that role and kind of understand if they have the behavior / temperament to manage that. So a person who's highly fidgety and highly imaginative and very creative and very prone to always be looking at making changes, you know, isn't going to do, for the most part, a good bookkeeper job.
Right.
Right. So there's relevance to all that. They might have been a bookkeeper, but that doesn't mean that's really how they're ideally suited.
Well, and that's a big part that you play in working with your clients is the interpretive side of all this data that you get is saying, well, for the role you're considering this person for, this assessment shows they'd probably be a good fit.
Right.
But oftentimes,
there are times when it's just, you know, blatantly. Right. Probably going to create more problems for you. And my job is not to tell the client to hire or not hire. My job is to tell the client, these are the behaviors that this person exhibits, and this is how they're liable to manifest themselves. And this is liable to what you'll be faced with. And at least you know going in that, you know, these could be challenging areas for them. Case in point, one of my engineering firms was hiring a project manager. And looking at the scores, I said, look, on a good day, she's probably going to be a pretty good fit. But on her worst day, there's probably going to be challenges. And I can't tell you how many more worse days than good days she's going to have, but I can tell you that the behaviors that are prevalent are telling me that she's got a little bit of defiance, but she's smart and she's driven and she's competitive and she's, you know, hardwired to succeed, but she's got some pieces where she may not be as strong in the areas of being able to kind of push things through in a positive light versus ram things through. And that was kind of my advice. And within 2 weeks, those things were playing out. Within 2 weeks, I let her go.
Well, one of the things when we first started brainstorming around this episode, we spent some time talking about substance abuse. And I'm curious, can this assessment identify someone as a substance abuser? I mean, talk to me about, I think there was a study that maybe sheds a little bit more light on that question about maybe it doesn't necessarily identify someone as a substance abuser, but it begins to shine a light on some behaviors and some emotional issues that could potentially signify potential trouble there. Talk about that whole issue.
Yeah. So several years back, one of my colleagues who I've become very close with, we've done a lot of work together, approached me and in his practice, he's a clinical psychologist as well, Dr. Neil. And he said to me, you know, can the 16PF predict substance abuse? And I said, to my knowledge, no, I don't know that I would go that far. So I concurred with Dr. Watterson, Dr. Carson, and asked them the same thing. They said, hey, you're probably right. It's probably a stretch, but we've never been able to compile enough statistical data to really support that theory, right? So I went back to Dr. Neil and I said, you know, I've talked to two of my advisors and we just don't think it's, you know, going to be viable. But if we were to do that, though, we would need a sizable sample size of people who are, in fact, heavy substance abuse users, whether it be heroin, whether it be narcotics, whether it be opioids, whether it be, you know, drug and alcohol, whatever. But they'd have to really be strong, identifiable people who truly have substance abuse issues. And then if we could get them to participate in a study and be willing to take the 16PF, we might be able to get some empirical data to support all that. So Dr. Neil and I and another individual worked together to kind of pull that together. And the end result was we had identified about 140 some people with substance abuse issues that volunteered to take 16PF. And in Dr. Carson's work, we've always told our clients that if three or more areas of concern emerge on a person's report, that it's probably best to move on, that there may be more baggage than what you want to deal with. given those factors.
So of the 15, three or more raises a flag.
Correct.
To give strong consideration to not moving forward. Okay.
That's correct. Right. And those, like I said, those factors are populated within the report as it comes out. So when we were all said and done the study and Dr. Carson ran the study data, he was blown away that we were able to have this as much of a predictive value as we did. And the basis of that is that we took a population of 5,000 people out of our database from all of our clients over the years who'd looked to hire people and took and ran all their data. And then we took the 140 plus people that were in the substance abuse study and we ran their data and we compared the two group control groups. So we had a standard group with 5,000 people who had already applied for jobs, and we had a control group with 140 substance abuse people who volunteered to take the 16PF so we could kind of look at how they're wired. And 81%, I think it was, or 85% of the substance abuse population had three or more areas of concern. Some had as many as 9 and 10.
Wow.
But the real common thread was that entire control group of substance abusers, they had, there was an average score of anxiety, which was high, and a low self-control score. So if you stop and think about people who have substance abuse issues, usually have some type of emotional issues or baggage that they're dealing with. And because the 16PF measures anxiety, and we can look at those characteristics and kind of pinpoint those, we can have a much more clear idea that this person may have too many disruptors within kind of how they're wired to take a chance on.
Well, it's fascinating to think about this because, yeah, I mean, you could make someone take a drug test.
Right.
And you might get a direct result saying, yes, there's alcohol in this person's system, and you right. kind of have a sense. But what's fascinating to think about with this 16PF is that you're not reading blood work here. You're getting a sense on emotional strength or weaknesses and, right. and anxiety. Right. And you can test and you can get good reads on all those emotional type issues.
Yeah.
And you now, because of the result of that study, you can almost map it and say, all right, I can almost... This, I don't think you can say 100% that you can make a complete assessment on whether they're a substance abuser or not.
Well, we don't go that far to make that kind of statement.
Right. So you can't use it as that.
No.
But you can probably see some of these areas of potential concern that are raised as a result of the survey, and you can begin to make educated guesses that this right. there's potential problem here.
Yeah. So for example, if we take two of the scores, there's a score on that measures resilience. Okay. That's factor C. And then there's a factor, what we call factor O, which is the worry factor. But when we see people who score low on the resilience factor and score high on the worry factor, we know that as a general rule, that person doesn't cope well with things in general. And especially little things that crop up that they're not prepared for kind of set them off.
Yeah.
Right? If you take those two factors and you add one more factor of the 15, which is suspicion, now you get someone who is argumentative and untrusting of others, and will act out. So even though there are 15 individual factors identified as areas of potential concern, it's the aggregate of those in combination that really starts to show you that person's true colors, right? And that's the predictive value of the instrument. And being able to look at 3, 4, or even 5 factors and how they play on one another. So for example, a high score on being socially needy and a low score on independence or reliance on others, those two factors equate to someone who is socially needy and oftentimes has a hard time with discipline or distancing themselves from others and may spend more time looking for attaboys or attagirls, always looking for reinforcement, right? So there's certain factors that come into play that, again, as we've talked in other, you know, I use DeHogan, I use the DISC, and I've used Myers-Briggs, and most of those assessments aren't as far-reaching as what we're talking about right now.
Right.
So when we get back to the substance abuse study, when Doc Neal said, you know, what would we need? I said, well, we need at least 100, right? And as we sorted through the entire population, we had a couple hundred people respond to our process. Out of that, we only took a few of those that we felt were the most based on a 6-question factor that we as our screening. And as we ran that data and we ran those assessments, 85% of that population, or 81%, I forget what the figure was, but over 80% of that substance use population had three or more areas of concern.
I was just watching the film The Matrix the other day, and there was a scene where Neo and another guy are looking at a computer monitor, and it's showing The Matrix, which is just a bunch of flowing numbers that makes no sense to most people. but someone who knows what they're doing can see that and actually see a picture. I'm laughing because I think of you as reading the matrix. I've seen the output sheet, the score sheet of a 16PF, and there's just this grid with all these numbers, and it doesn't make any sense to me, but you can look at that and you can almost paint a darn near exact portrait of that human being and the struggles they have, the anxieties they face, their strengths, their weaknesses.
I call it reading the tea leaves.
But I hope people listening kind of understand, yeah, it's one thing to get a sheet, a printout of all this data. Interpreting that is the real strength. I mean, but you have, these numbers don't lie. That's what's so fascinating. Listening to all your stories and people that you've advised your clients on over the years, and how high your batting average is quite impressive. I mean,
well, the prolific thing is, and back to the book, you know, chapter 12 has, I don't know, half a dozen, eight or nine case studies, right? And one of the case studies that's really always stood out was this lady who was extremely bright. She had 118 IQ. She was in the 70th percentile on her cognitive and her verbal and her cognitive, linguistic and quantitative scales. Just a smart lady, very aggressive, very driven, but she had a high assertiveness score, a high suspicion score, and a high need for change score. And the output of those factors is someone who's aggressive and angry at the world, has a chip on their shoulder and prone to fight. Well, she would constantly get into arguments with people. And so they did promote her because they were hoping to advance her. And within 6 months, they let her go because she was just so caustic. Well, and we tell the client, look, this is, you know, this title's probably going to go to her head over time. We just didn't know what time frame, but within 6 months. And this is a person who'd been in the employ of this organization for several years in customer service roles and pushed for a role in management, and they gave her a shot and she crashed and burned. Well, we predicted that based on the assessment scores. And besides that, the identifiable behaviors that she exhibited on a day-to-day basis anyway, even before she took the role. So when you start then taking the substance abuse data that we received and you take Dr. Carson's work with the areas of potential concern and how those tie together, as I mentioned, we had people in that substance abuse study that had as many as 8, 9, and even 10 of the 15 factors show up in their personality.
Yeah. You know, one thing I've learned from you through this whole series is that the best way to predict performance is understanding their behavior. The other thing I've learned is that majority of the assessments, good assessments that have specific value for specific needs, but most of these assessments are too simple or they only show you normal behaviors. And as we're talking about today, this is unreliable behaviors. And a lot of these assessments can't necessarily weed those out.
No, because it isn't that because they're not, those item factors are not measured.
Right.
Right. So it stands to reason that any four-dimensional model, right, Berkman, DISC, predictive index, Myers-Briggs, those are all four-dimensional models. It's obvious then, I mean, just the layperson would say, well, four factors versus 16 factors. Well, of course, you're going to get a deeper read on someone with 16 factors. But it's the combination of those factors more than it is the individual factors.
Right.
But one of the interesting things that came out of the study was, when you think about people who have some type of substance abuse issue, usually they have a defiant side, right? And usually they're bucking the system or bucking society norms. What was really fascinating was 40-some percent, almost 45 of that 140, had a high score on suspicion, which is a lack of trust of others, and a low score on factor G, which is just rule defiant. And so when you have 45% of population score high on anger and aggression and low on being, you know, thumb to you, right, in terms of respect for rules and authority, it's not all that surprising to see then that they've got some type of challenge. Now, the other interesting piece is, though, that 5% of that population showed to have no abnormal behaviors, but showed to have borderline. And what do I mean by that? Well, so each of these factors has a cutoff score to where it really becomes a negative component. So on a scale of 1 to 10, our factor on being rule-bound or rule-conscious, anything that's a 3 or lower is considered having some defiance to them in terms of society rules. If they scored a 4 on that scale, it wouldn't flag that as an area of concern because it didn't hit the cutoff score. So being able to see then that a person who is suspicious would have a score of 8 or greater, well, what if a profile shows up and that person has a low rule defiance of a 4, which doesn't hit the cutoff scale, and has a high suspicion but doesn't hit the cutoff scale, only a 7 versus an 8, you wouldn't pick that out that they may have some challenges unless you really knew what you were looking for.
Right.
Right. So the combination patterns that are there is where the interpretive value really comes into play. And the challenge is getting a computer that can dissect all that and that you can push all that stuff in so it pushes it back out. So this is why, on the reports, the areas of potential concern is a critical page to pay attention to in our, on our personnel report.
Well, that's where I was going to go next. As we record this episode, earlier this week, the news came out about Matthew Perry. He was the beloved actor on the iconic television show Friends, who everyone loved. He was funny. We now know he's putting out his memoirs where he's talking about his, through most of the duration of the production of that television show, he was suffering from severe addiction issues. And it explains his weight loss and his weight gain and the way he was, his appearance was always changing. Even this beloved Chandler, everyone loved this guy, but had real issues. We're talking about humans here, Rick. We're right. Flawed. We're messy. We're imperfect. And we're talking about hiring for your organization. And it's important to get the right person in there to do the job the way you need it to be done. It's worth going through this effort to really try to understand
what you would think.
These hires.
And there's some clients who, you know, really have seen this process play out over and over and over again. And they will make sure that they test everyone they hire. And there's some that are just kind of anti-assessment, or they don't, or maybe the assessment they used previously didn't work, which is not uncommon. I think the clients that have been with me, you know, I mean, year 32, I think I've been doing this, and I've got clients that have been with me since almost day one.
Yeah.
Big automotive client. It's grown from 18 million to 100 million in revenue in the years we've been working together. A couple major clients we have that came to us at back in 2008. You know, still use us. And so the range of clients we have from a $4 million engineering firm to a $9 million printing company, you know, and all things in between, the companies that are committed to really hiring a great workforce are going to spend the money because, I mean, it's not a cheap process. I mean, we try to bring it in as economical as possible, but
it's an investment that's worthwhile making. And the time involved is an investment worthwhile making. I look back at my hiring over the years and a lot of it was done by my gut. Oh, I have a good feeling about this guy. And I got burned plenty of times. These numbers, I mean, as I'm growing to understand your assessment process and how this, for example, the 16 PF works, these numbers don't lie. They really don't. This data doesn't lie. There's a reason your batting average is so good, Rick, because these assessments work the way that you guys do them.
Yeah. So when you think about the reason that when Doc Neal came to me and said, you know, can we predict substance abuse? I said, no, but we can identify the behaviors that may be consistent with people who do have substance abuse issues.
Right.
That's the real piece here, right? We're not telling clients that our process will predict someone who has a substance abuse issue, but our process can predict someone who has some disruptive elements to their behavior. Are they angry? Are they even keeled? Do they lose their cool? Do they have a hard time thinking problems through? The data speaks to the behavior. Well, when you go back and you look at the substance abuse study, those are behaviors of people who aren't coping with something for some reason, right? And so it's the coping mechanism piece that is consistent with the substance abuse study. Well, the coping mechanism, which is not measured by most other assessments, as I continue to repeat that, the coping mechanism that shows up on whether or not they have coping ability showed up in spades, if you will, in the substance abuse study. So when you think about coping skills, okay, those elements, there's four factors. Of the 16 PF factors, there's four factors that feed into the coping component piece. And what we found was that 85% of the substance population had high scores on anxiety, which is the negative side of coping, and had low scores on self-control. So when you think about the anxiety piece and a little self-control, then they don't have the emotional wherewithal to be able to manage some of the pressures or stress that they're under, hence where they go then to some type of relief, obviously, substance abuse or whatever. But the other thing, interesting point was 5% of that substance abuse population did not reveal any areas of concern, which means that some of the scores they had might have been more borderline, but it also tells us this isn't foolproof, but there's a high probability it can have a strong predictive value. And so the message here is not that we're going to tell you if they have a substance abuse issue, because that's not what we're saying. We're saying that the behaviors that they exhibit are, in general, abnormal behaviors. And when there are at least three or more areas that emerge on that page, you should highly consider whether or not those factors are conducive to the role that they're in.
Got it. All right. Good stuff. That's all the time we have for today. Rick, before I let you go, should anyone have any questions on this topic that we covered today and want to get their hands on a copy of the study that we've been talking about, how do they do that?
Just email me at rick@theeg.com, T-H-E-E-G.com, and we'll send out a study. And anybody who wants a copy of the book, we'll be glad to send a copy of the book as well.
Yeah, so that book is Developing World-Class Leaders, The Ultimate Guide to Leadership Development. So they can email you and ask questions, get a copy of this study, as well as get a copy of that book. All right. Well, on behalf of our series host, Mr. Rick Thiemann, I am Todd Schnick. We'll see you next time on A Strategic View of Hiring. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to the special edition series, A Strategic View of Hiring. This series is made possible by The Executive Group, linking human capital with strategic intent, building organizational talent, and developing both world-class leaders and Salesforce effectiveness. To learn more, visit The Executive Group online at theeg.com. That's theeg.com.